Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Cheryl Gerber, author of New Orleans, Life and Death in the Big Easy. We'll also talk with Kristen Hirsch, author of Don't Suck, Don't Die, Giving Up Fig Chestnut. New Orleans native Cheryl Gerber is a well-known freelance journalist and documentary photographer who's been taking photos of her hometown for 25 years. Now she's collected some of her best work in a book, New Orleans, Life and Death in the Big Easy. You've probably seen her work in Gambit or New Orleans Magazine, but trust me, you've never seen it like this. It's an amazing chronicle of deep observation and attention. Cheryl Gerber, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, the idea for this book began with a very specific pairing of images, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It did. It started at the coffee table. One morning, I was lamenting how I didn't have a body of work. It occurred to me that I've been photographing New Orleans for 25 years, but I've been photographing every assignment I could get my hands on, everything from rich people's houses and parties, bar mitzvahs, to crime scenes, oil spills, and Katrina. And I was comparing myself to Michael P. Smith and Cindy Bird, who I worked for Michael in the early 1990s. And he had this amazing collection of black culture, jazz fest, Mardi Gras Indians, all the street life that I loved. And I had photos of those, but I didn't have a body of work that would be like his. And I thought that I just squandered my entire 25 years photographing everything I could to make money. And my husband looks at me and he goes, "Are you crazy? Of course you have a body of work. You've been photographing New Orleans for 25 years. There's something there." So he suggested I go in and start looking at my photos. And I'll be darned, I couldn't find anything that was related. Everything was helter-skelter. But one day, by chance, I was editing a photo of a high-profile socialite at the New Orleans Ballet Association's fundraiser, and the theme was Marie Antoinette, and she had this beautiful blonde hair swept up on top of her head in a Marie Antoinette-like style. And I looked over on the other side of the screen, and I saw a photo I had taken of an African-American woman at a Treme second line with a very similar blonde, stiff, coiffed hairdo. And I looked at these two women who each are quintessential New Orleans ladies. Mm-hmm. But there they are side by side on my computer. And I wondered, like, had they ever crossed paths in New Orleans? Probably not. But maybe they did. And so I started looking for more of these juxtapositions. And I just found one, two, three, four after the other. One of my favorites, though, is of Archbishop Hughes. He's at a St. Joseph's Day altar behind St. Louis Cathedral, and he's wearing his long pink robe, and he's holding up his staff. And I'm not Catholic, so I don't know the exact symbolism behind the staff, but I assume he's tending his flock.
Right.
So right above that photo, I have a drag queen from Southern Decadence dressed in all pink, and she's dressed as Little Bo Peep, and she's holding up her staff, tending her flock.
That's one of my favorites, too. And then on the other page, you have the pussyfooters.
Yeah.
And the black men of labor, all in pink and white.
And that, you know, James Wilson, the publisher from UL Press, he loved those four pictures together.
I did, too.
He loved the pink, so.
Yeah. And then, so you began to see your work in a new way and began to see that you had a body of work.
I did. And the remarkable thing about it was, it mimicked my life. And, you know, the original title for this book was New Orleans, I Love You, I Hate You, which is very,
that would work. You know, that would work.
I think most New Orleanians can relate to that. And that's kind of how New Orleans is. When you first see it, when you first arrive, everything's colorful and beautiful and full of life. But after you're here a while, you start seeing the darker side. And as I delved deeper into my archives, I started finding these juxtapositions that really demonstrated the inequalities and the disparities that make life really hard in New Orleans. I think the first one that I found and the most symbolic to me is the photo of the three children jumping into the JCC's bright blue swimming pool. That's what every kid should do. But one day I had an assignment from the New York Times to work on a story about poverty in New Orleans, and they asked me to go out and try to find examples of poverty. Well, I didn't have to go far. I live in the Marigny, and I crossed over St. Claude just a couple of blocks into the 7th Ward and found these two boys jumping off of the porch onto discarded mattresses with litter strewn all around. And, you know, those are the kind of things that make life really hard when you drive around the city. You really do see the disparities and the inequalities.
Because you really are constantly bearing witness,
you know,
to what's here.
It's true.
That's one of the things I love about this book, because it does have that definite point of view. It does have a narrative line in a way. You can read these pictures.
Oh, good. Well, that's what I was hoping for, because it reminds me of kind of how New Orleans is. And the first part of the book starts off real colorful like that. Then by the middle, you see some of those disparities. Another couple that I really like is the photo of, I think it's the Common Ground Health Clinic that provided free health care to poor New Orleanians after Katrina. I think it was on the West Bank. But I walked into this waiting room, and it was a makeshift waiting room. It probably was a blighted building at one point. And there were all these poor people, not looking happy at all, sitting on folding chairs in this waiting room. And there was this one guy right in the middle of the picture, a young African-American male, and he's sitting back, staring into the camera with his hands on top of his head. And he's wearing this white T-shirt with a big American flag that says United States of America. Well, in 2009, I had to go photograph one of David Vitter's town hall meetings about the health care bill that Obama was trying to pass, the Affordable Health Care Bill. And there were a lot of screaming people at that meeting. In particular, where there was this one woman in the middle of the crowd screaming how she hated this bill, didn't want it to go through. And just by chance, she's wearing a white shirt with an almost identical American flag that says patriotism. So those are the kind of things that I see on a daily basis.
Yeah, that was pretty stunning. But on the joyful side of this book, there are whole pages of kisses.
Oh.
Whole pages of shaking booties.
Just by chance. Oh, I call the shaking booty one behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes, indeed.
I have a photo. You can't do this now, but in the old days, you used to be able to walk into the Oz Dance Club on Bourbon Street and take photos. But because of so many protesters, they quit allowing cameras in there. But I have photos of these guys dancing on the bar with their little bikini pants on.
Yes.
And then another photo that's almost identical of the bust-out burlesque dancers from behind. And of course, no butt photo would be complete without Big Frida's.
Big Frida, absolutely.
Butt-shaking photos.
And then you have Trombone Shorty, over 20 years.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorites, too, because one of the things that Mike Smith taught me, more than the photography part, is he said, you know, when you go out, photograph these little kids, because you never know who they're going to grow up to be. And sure enough, Trombone Shorty, I photographed him when he was probably 5 or 6 years old. And I paired that with a photo of him at Jazz Fest, of him with his all-black leather outfit, holding up his trombone and screaming. Yeah. Very adult.
Very much grown up. And you've also been to a lot of funerals.
Yeah, a lot of funerals.
Including some of the weirder and more recent ones.
Well, the weirder ones I'll talk about in a second. I guess I could tell you about these four photographs. New Orleans has a unique way of celebrating death, and fortunately, I was able to get Chris Rose to write a really nice essay about the ironies of life in New Orleans, and he particularly wrote a nice section about how we celebrate and mourn death. So these four funerals start off with the funeral for famed jazz musician Harold Desjean at St. Louis No. 3 Cemetery. And that was back in 2002, and the pallbearers wearing all white, dashiki-like outfits with white gloves, and they're carrying the coffin with a flag draped across. And below that, I have a funeral for oil tycoon and philanthropist Patrick Taylor in the French Quarter, and he's being carried by New Orleans policemen who, if anybody remembers him, he gave a lot lot of money to the New Orleans Police Department. And then another funeral, which was really sad, was for Magnolia Shorty, the rapper who was shot multiple times in front of her apartment. There are these very somber-looking men wearing black tuxedos and the white gloves holding on to the horse-drawn hearse as they go by. And then the last one is for funeral Archbishop Philip Hannon, who is being escorted by priests with his horse-drawn carriage. So there are four completely different types of people with four different funerals that have so much similarity that it's almost eerie.
Well, that's the thing. Some spooky similarities here. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I don't want to give it away, but the last two pictures are perfection.
Oh, thanks.
And people will have to buy the book to see those two.
Great.
And you called upon, in addition to Chris Rose, Lola Sarah Gilai has contributed writing to this book.
And you know, just like the book is juxtapositions of photographs, I feel like Chris Rose and Lola Sarah Gilai are two of my favorite writers in this city, yet completely different in the way that they write, where Chris finds the ironies and the humor in life in New Orleans, and Lola's is more of the concentrating on race and inequalities and those sort of things in the history of New Orleans. So I was really fortunate to get the two of them. And besides all of that, we all paralleled each other in our careers. We're all about the same age, and was very grateful when they each said that they would write something.
Well, it's a beautiful book and very thought-provoking.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Cheryl Gerber, whose new book is New Orleans, Life and Death in the Big Easy. You can meet her Thursday, November 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Kristen Hirsch is a founding member of the bands Throwing Muses and 50 Foot Wave. Her memoir, Rat Girl, was an amazing account of the rock and roll life, and she's followed that up with a new memoir, Don't Suck, Don't Die, Giving Up Vic Chestnut, a painful and very beautiful account of her friendship with the singer-songwriter. Kristen, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much.
Now, sometimes I just put a book down and I want to go, wow, did that person really do that? Did they throw that much life up on the page? And that's the way I felt when I finished this book.
Aren't you kind?
Oh, no, I'm not kind.
Well, I didn't feel like I was being very kind by recording it. It was so raw, and I write in that time after night and before morning when your brain's a little freer than it should be, a little more adept at recalling sense memories. And sometimes I feel like that's an exercise in cruelty. But with this subject matter, as black and white as it appears to be, Vic's wife Tina and I were talking last week about just what a capital F fun excerpt in our lives that was. You know, you never know a decade until you identify it after the fact. And
of course,
this was a decade of joy. As she said, what we did out of love, and that's as joyful as you can be. So these sense memories were, for the most part, very joyful. And when they got dark, the joy had set me up for intensity. And I never went to truly bad places in this book for love of the other three people who shared the story with me.
Right. Now, introduce us to Vic Chestnut, that complicated person. I mean, you know, there are so many visual images of him that you can find online, documentaries, videos, and here he is on the page. What is it like to try and capture him that way?
Apparently, this is the only book about him, which makes me very sad. I want everyone who knew him to write a book, and then we can compare, because he is enigmatic, if nothing else. He used to call what he did lying, and I think what he meant was, I'm telling an extra truth.
Yes.
He would color his impressions to the point where he no longer felt that he was reflecting reality, when what he was doing was putting Vic goggles on you. And that's really the only reason I had to write this, that and the hope that people would listen to his music. I had to be talked into this. I didn't feel like I should be allowed to write anything close to a biography, and I didn't, obviously. I wrote a dream, and it's nonfiction, but that's what memories are like. That's what impressions are like, and that's why it's called a memoir.
Right. So tell us about how you first met.
I met him through a mutual friend, and we did not connect particularly because he acted so weird. And I also didn't see a wheelchair anywhere. He was leaning over his amp, messing with the toggles in the back, which is something I do a lot. He was at sound check, and the wheelchair must have just been pushed aside. And that was the last time I ever saw him stand. He ignored me when we were introduced, and then someone said, not just Kristen, but Hirsch to him, and then he pretended to bow to me. I just thought he was a weirdo, which he did turn out to be. You know, that's as far as first impressions go, that's an accurate one. But then we toured together. We toured Europe on my first solo tour, and I did not know how to play solo acoustic in front of audiences, and they put me in big theaters where I had to find this rickety stool. They always, you know, if you're female, they put you on this rickety stool. It's like, and I was used to taking out my contact lenses so I could be in a fog of sound. I had to learn to wear my contacts, see the audience so I could find the stool, climb on top of it, not fall down, not bump into the mic, which makes this boom sound that everybody can hear. And Vic was sort of talking me through that because he was used to playing acoustic. And if you're on tour with people, you either sit and stare at them for months at a time, or you sit and stare at them and connect for months at a time. And Vic and I and our spouses decided to sit and stare and connect. And that's what became so intense. We felt alone in the world and yet alone together in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that this book does so brilliantly is really describe what a tour is like. I mean, the grime and the exhaustion and the, you know, the incredible relentlessness of it.
It's a repetitive, intriguing lifestyle.
Yeah.
What I recorded in the book is our conversations we had over and over again, experiences we had over and over again, and it's sort of like x-rays or photographs of those laid over each other until you get to the essential of each one. Mm-hmm. And so the play that we were living out was one of squalor and hunger and hangovers and crazy fans and dirty alleys and sort of the shadow of what one sees when you go to a show.
Exactly.
And it's okay. What you learn is you don't want, you need. And then you learn what you need. And for us, it was music. And that sounds so lame. But when your music is real, it will carry you through anything. I don't know how those bands that fake it get by. I think that's why they fight, why they do drugs. We were so clean and we were so happy and we felt like we were on a mission, all four of us. Like Tina said, this is love. And we loved everybody because we loved what we did and we loved each other.
And this book originally started as a magazine article, right? That just grew and grew and grew.
That's me being stupid. I thought no, I was asked to write an article and I said, sure, meaning probably not. I'm just nice and a liar. And they called 6 months later to ask how it was coming along. And I said, oh, you meant really? Well, how many words did you want? And when they told me, I said, that's a really long article. They said, yeah, we're a publishing company. You told us you'd write a book. Now do it.
Oh, nothing like the heavy whip of the publisher coming to town.
But it was good for me. I wrote it gleefully, and then everything went dark. So the skeleton of this story is a lovely fairy tale of a memory, and how it was fleshed out and filled in is darkness accepted.
Right.
So that I can take. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no problem doing these readings. When I read from my last book, Rat Girl, it hurts.
Interesting.
I try to read only the funny stuff. But this book doesn't hurt because it began in safety and it ended in free fall. But that's for me to learn to live with. That's not for the reader to take on.
You know, they say that every book teaches you how to write it. Every book gives you what you need to have gotten from it. And I wonder how this book has moved you on the next step of your writing life.
All I know is that every work that is publishable should create itself. Mm-hmm. Only because when I get in the way of a song, it's half-assed. It's not what it should have been. If I get in the way of a child, it's not what it should have been. I can't tell them what to say or be. And if I get in the way of a book, it's not what it should have been. So I'm not someone who will have an idea and then let it play out. Something has to be born or I won't facilitate it. I know better.
Well, learning to get out of your own way is like a great, great gift for anybody.
I really like invisibility. My kids quiz me on what superpower I would have, and I keep sticking with invisibility, and that sounds so boring to them, but someday I'm going to get there.
I kind of like that.
I'm going to show them how cool it is. I'm pretty invisible already. I come close.
So what has the tour been like for you? I mean, you're out there on the road for a book instead of an album, and this has your heart in it, so much of your heart in this book. What is the response that you're getting that means the most to you?
It's interesting to me to speak English to people having spoken music to them for so many years and confused a lot of people who aren't fluent in that language. Mm-hmm. That's truly the only music, I mean, the only language I am fluent in is music. And that makes me speak English oddly.
But interestingly.
And it does translate.
Yes.
And this is a music book, so I'm also playing shows. And I'm sometimes playing music and readings, and the text informs the music and vice versa. So I find my comfort and release and my invisibility in the music. And when I come back to text, they find their comfort because that's their window into what I do.
Right. Well, I can't wait for your next one. I read a lot of memoirs, and I think this is right up there with the very best. So
thank you, Susan.
So thank you. We've been talking with part-time New Orleanian Kristen Hirsch, whose new memoir is Don't Suck, Don't Die, Giving Up Vic Chestnut. Let's go out on one of Vic's songs, I Flirted With You All My Life. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I am a man. I am self-aware, and everywhere I go, you're always right there with me. I've flirted with you all my life, even kissed you once or twice, and to this day I swear it was nice, but clearly I was not ready. When you touched a friend of mine, I thought I would lose my mind, but I found out with time that really I was not ready. No, no. Oh, death. Oh, death. Oh, death. Really, I'm not ready.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by Michael Lewis, Tuesday, November 3rd at 5:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Nkoma Wangugi, author of Mrs. Shaw, is the featured reader at the 1718 Reading Series, Tuesday, November 3rd at 6 at the Columns Hotel. Sally Asher, author of Stories from St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans, and Maggie Bacinelli, author of New Orleans Neighborhoods, A Cultural Guide, discuss and sign the Bookstore Books Tuesday, November 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tom Piazza, author of A Free State, discusses his book at 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 3rd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of Coffee and Conversation, sponsored by the Library and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Photographer Tina Freeman and authors Carol McMichael Reese and Walter Stern will present a special discussion and sign their new book, Longview House and Gardens, The Architecture, Interiors, and Gardens of New Orleans' Most Celebrated Estate, Wednesday, November 4th at 4 in the Playhouse at Longview on Bamboo Road. John Besh signs Besh Big Easy, 101 Home-Cooked New Orleans Recipes, Wednesday, November 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poppy Tooker signs Toujac's Cookbook, Recipes and Lore in the Grand Creole Tradition, Wednesday, November 4th at 6 at Octavia Books, and Tuesday, November 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Adrian Van Young, author of The Man Who Noticed Everything, and Michael Allen Zell, author of Run Baby Run, read from and sign their work Wednesday, November 4th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Cheryl Gerber, signs New Orleans Life and Death in the Big Easy, Thursday, November 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The first poetry reading that's part of Lady Fest takes place Thursday, November 5th at 6 at 2448 North Villery. Featured poets include Phyllis Paroon, Nancy Dixon, Sarah Giacobelli, Izzy Onerick, Andrea Young, Nancy Harris, Jessica Ruby Radcliffe, Gina Ferrara, Roxy Shea, Emily Ewings, Lisa Passel, Laura McKnight, and Stacey Balkin. The Unlikely Saints poetry reading, featuring Wendy Taylor Carlisle, Michael Harold, Carolyn Hembree, Alexandra Johnson, Larissa Schmalo, and Christopher Shipman, takes place Thursday, November 5th at 6 at Crescent City Books. Johnette Downing reads from and signs Louisiana, Jewel of the Deep South, Ten Gators on the Bed, and Bugs in a Rug, Saturday, November 7th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Pam Castor signs Patsy the Mule and the Roman Candyman, Saturday, November 7th at 2 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Book Festival begins Friday, November 6th from 6:30 to 8 with an evening of music under the stars at Ladder Library on St. Charles Avenue. The fest continues with a full day of book presentations and children's activities Saturday, November 7th from 10 to 4 at Big Lake in City Park. The Dream Caravan is a full weekend of lectures, panels, workshops, and private consultations coordinated to appeal to a wide range of dreamers. Dreams and Poetry is curated by Megan Burns and Roger Kamenetz and features Kelly Harris DeBerry, Brad Richard, Peter Cooley, Valentine Pierce, Andrea Young, Alexis Gums, Russell Swenson, and Elizabeth Gross. That takes place Sunday, November 8th from 4 to 6 at the Arts Estuary, 1024 St. Claude Avenue. Admission by donation. For more info, check out dreamcaravan.com. Suzanne Reinstein signs Rooms for Living, A Style for Today with Things from the Past, Monday, November 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Pamela Newkirk discusses and signs Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Binga, Monday, November 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Southwest Chapter of the Mystery Writers of America presents Mystery Writers of America University in New Orleans. That's November 14th at the Windsor Court Hotel. Instructors include best-selling authors Laura Lippman, Megan Abbott, Allison Galen, Erica Spindler, and Bill Lofilm. For more information about the courses or Mystery Writers of America, and to register, go to mysterywriters.org/MWA-University. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.